So it is my privilege and honor to introduce our speaker to you. Dr. Kurt Thompson is a board-certified psychiatrist by the American Board of Psychiatry and Neurology. He is the founder of the Center for Being Known, which develops teaching programs, seminars, and resource materials to help people explore the connection between interpersonal neurobiology and Christian spirituality. Dr. Thompson is the author of Anatomy of the Soul, as well as The Soul of Shame. He's a graduate of Wright State University School of Medicine and completed his residency at Temple University Hospital. Dr. Thompson's been married for 30 years to his wife, Phyllis. They're parents of two children, reside in Arlington, Virginia, and he serves as an elder at Washington Community Fellowship in Washington, D.C. So please join me in welcoming today's speaker, Dr. Kurt Thompson.
Good morning. It's always a good thing when people applaud before I've said a word. Oh, it's that kind of crowd. And it's always a good thing too, because there are 300-400 of you. I don't know how many are here, and you're here on a Friday to talk about like the most encouraging topic you can think about, right? The topic of shame. The news about shame is far worse than you know. And far better than you can imagine. I'd like to have you keep that in mind. That the news about shame is far worse than you know, and at the same time, far better than you can imagine. Which is why it's so important if we're going to live life, that we are living life together. One of the things, you'll hear an awful lot from me this weekend, these next 2 days, about the brain works and different features of it. And one of the things that we like to say about the brain is the brain is willing to do a lot of things that are hard to do, but what it doesn't really like to do is to do hard things by itself. It longs to be in the company of others if we're going to do hard work. And I will tell you, following Jesus is hard to do. You buy that? It's hard to do. It's really hard to do. And it doesn't mean that it is overly burdensome, but it takes effort. And if we're going to do that effectively, most significantly, we want to do that in the company of others who are doing the same thing. Right on? By the way, I attend a church where people talk to the preacher. Now, I'm not preaching, but I'm happy for you to talk to me if you want to. So, there you go. Right. Thank you. I have one in a room. Great. I have one. Just some further things. So for full disclosure purposes, just so you know, so you get a sense of who you're dealing with here this morning. First, I'll apologize in advance once for the next 2 days. I'm at the end of about 2 weeks of an upper respiratory infection, so I may be coughing a bit. So I'll just apologize now for that, and then just cough all over you and not say a word after that. Number one. Number two. I like to let people know, more than anything else, my life as a married man and as a father has, those things have been the most shaping things for me in the last 30 years about who I am. And I'm grateful that I'm married to a woman who's willing to stick around, because it's not always easy to stick around me. And my kids, of course, have all left the house for the same reason. Like, it's not easy to stick around dad, but they're supposed to. We have a daughter who is 26 and a son who's 23. you'll hear more about them over the course of these next 2 days. And the other thing that I tell people is that I'm not just a sinner, but I'm a professional sinner. Because I think that as long as you do something for a long time and you're really good at it, you should be able to call yourself a professional. And that's what I do. You know, how many times, I wish this was different. I wish that I didn't have this proclivity, but it's true. And then the other thing just to note then is that for a living, I'm a psychiatrist. And I work in Washington, D.C., which is a pretty good gig. Yep, every 2 years we have an election. People are anxious beforehand and depressed afterwards. We get them coming or going. Yep, constant stream of revenue. That's your taxes at work. And we're here today. I want to give us just a rundown on how we want this time to work. We're going to go this morning until about 10:45. We're going to take a 15-minute break. We're going to call you back. We're going to go till from 11 to 12, and then we're going to have 30 minutes of Q&A. We've got a couple of microphones here, and then we'll have lunch for an hour and a half. We'll come back, and we'll then have a similar kind of schedule this afternoon. I'm going to ask you to do something right now, though, that inherently tends to encourage people to be anxious. You know what's coming. I'm going to invite you to not just turn your cell phones off. I'm going to invite you to put them away. I'm going to invite you to put them in your purses, put them on the floor where you can't step on them. You're not going to want to do this. It's going to make you anxious, and it's going to give some psychiatrist business later this, tomorrow. Okay, now I just want you to pause for a moment, and I just want you to pay attention to something. We've asked you to do this, and I want you to pay attention to what you're sensing, what you're feeling, even right now, in this moment, in the wake of putting your cell phone away. Is anybody here feeling just a little bit of distress? Anybody? One person in all of Texas, two people, right. Now you might not, but I'm gonna tell you something. To the degree that you feel any shred of distress about putting your cell phone away, ultimately that's related to shame. And you might wonder, what's that got to do with that emotion? We'll learn about that. Because shame has everything to do with our sense that there is something inherently wrong with me. The sense that there is something inherently bad about me. The sense that I'm not enough, that I'm not okay. At the very core of my genetic code, there is something about me that is not okay. And the fact that I'm not okay means that if I don't have access to my phone and I miss something, something is not going to be okay, and I'm going to be responsible. There will be something wrong with me that I don't catch something. Are you with me? Yeah. So we see how even in small acts of restraint, shame comes to find us in our brains. We're going to explore a number of those different things over the course of our time together. But this is not just a 2-day seminar on shame. Moreover, this is mostly a seminar about how we tell stories. Shame just happens to be part of it. And it happens to be weaving its way in and out of our stories, often in ways that we aren't even paying attention to. Here's a question for you. We will come back to this over and over again in the next 2 days. In what story do you believe you're living? In what story do you believe you're living? Now, we might all say, well, I believe I'm living in the biblical story. I'm living in a world that was created by God and came in the form of Jesus, who's coming again And at some point, the new heaven and the new earth will arrive and everything will be changed forever. And so why am I so anxious when I put my phone away? If that's the case, right? If Jesus is coming and the whole heavens and earth are gonna be new, like, why am I worried about not having access to my phone? Like, you with me? But I am. Like, I'm up here, my phone's at that table and I'm anxious. In what story do we really believe we're living? As we'll see later today, we human beings do things that no other animal on the planet does. We tell stories. We tell stories of all kinds. You're telling stories even right now that you don't know that you're telling while you're sitting at your table. It is evil's intention to corrupt the story that you're telling and the one that you think you're living in. And it will use shame as its primary mechanism of doing so. And so we're also going to see that this is not a seminar just on shame or even just on stories. It's also a seminar that is intended to awaken us to what our purpose is. Right? We're not just created on earth to like live for 75 or 80 years and die happy. We were created, if we buy the Genesis narrative correctly, we were created to live like God lives. But to live like God lives means we are living to create things. And we create in multiple vocational domains. And by vocation, I don't just mean what you do for a living. For instance, if you're a woman, you are someone's daughter. You might be someone's wife, you're a friend. You might be an engineer. You might be an artist. You might be a teacher. You might be an athlete. You might be a sister. You might be a mother. You might be multiple different things. You have multiple different vocational domains that you occupy in which you have been called from before the foundation of the world to create, to live like God lives. I will tell you, evil wants none of this. Evil doesn't just use shame to make us feel bad about ourselves. Evil's intention is to use shame primarily to truncate and shear off your capacity to vocationally create in the domains that God wants you to create. Think of this, and we will come back to this question over and over and over again. I would if I could. Somebody should be recording this. And unfortunately, I'm really serious. Evil is a really bad guy. And his intention is to... Ask her. To truncate and shear off your capacity to create. And here's the thing. If we are not practicing these vocational callings, what do you think we're going to do when heaven gets here? If we're not practicing for heaven now, if we're not practicing loving the people that are hardest to love, if we're not practicing justice, when heaven gets here, it will crush us. And shame is evil's way of making sure that that's just exactly what happens. In what story do we believe that we're living? And is our story one of regeneration? Or is it one in which I'm just simply trying to get through the day? That's all I'm doing. I'm just trying to get to my pillow tonight. It's 10 o'clock in the morning. I'm looking for 10 o'clock tonight. That's what I'm looking for. Or am I walking out of my door in the morning, assuming that I am an agent of regeneration? Because I'm living out of God's delight in me. So a word about some of the way we're going to talk about this today, beyond what we've said already. Today, we're going to talk about some necessary and important elements of how human beings are made and how we work in order for us to have a clear sense of what evil is trying to do when it uses shame to corrupt us. The details about shame are coming tomorrow. We're going to hear some about it today, but the details about it are coming tomorrow. Today, we really want to talk about what are the elements of how we operate as human beings, how are we initially intended to operate as human beings, and what is it about that initial creative movement of God that evil has begun to corrupt? And it's important for us to know these things, because if we're not paying attention to these things, we won't be paying attention to where and how evil operates using shame as its primary weapon. But remember, this is not a seminar in which we're simply trying to find out better ways to not feel bad about ourselves. This is about how do we leave here to live as God lives? Which brings us to the question then of like, well, okay, what is shame anyway? Anybody here, to take a casual poll, has anybody here in the last month had anything that's happened which they've sensed, imaged, felt, thought, done anything for which they've had the least little bit of shame? Raise your hand. Right. Good. Okay. What about like in the last week? Anybody had that happen? Right? Good. What about like in the last hour? Right? Okay. Ma'am back there, would you like to come up and tell us what that was? Right. All right, so we all kind of get it, right? We kind of think, why do I need to go listen to a shrink talk, right? Because like I know what shame is. I don't need to go like sit with 300 people to figure out what I feel bad enough already. Anybody here of a person named Brené Brown? Yes. Right, like this is Texas. She's like right down the road, right? Just down the road, like 13 hours or something, wherever Houston is, right? This state that's the size of half the earth, okay? Right. Now, people ask me frequently, having written a book on shame, people say, well, what do you think about Brené Brown's work? And I say, I think two things. One, we could not be more fortunate to have someone like Brené Brown who's doing the work that she's doing. Could not be more fortunate. But the second thing is a more puzzling thing for me. I said, you know, it's odd. You'd think that with all of the notoriety that she has acquired because of the work that she's done with vulnerability and shame, you'd think that in the West, in the US, we had never heard of shame before in our lives. Like it's brand new. It was like we've never heard it in the Bible. It's as if like we've never heard of a guy by the name of John Bradshaw. Does the name John Bradshaw mean anything to anybody here? Right? 25 years ago, John Bradshaw writes a book called Healing the Shame That Binds You. It sells trillions of copies. It gets him a PBS special that lasts for years, right? And shame was all over the television for like 5 years. And then what happened? I would suggest it did what evil will do. When it is discovered, it will do everything it can to hide. And this is just what shame does. And I want to suggest to you that 25 years from now, we're going to need somebody else to come about and do the same work and help us discover shame again for the first time. This is something that's important for us to know. This is the way that it operates. Its necessary way of functioning is that when we sense it, when we feel it, we don't want to tell anyone about this. We want to remain in the dark because of the very nature of exposing it is so unpleasant. Does that make sense? It's important for us to be aware then that what we're doing here is really, really hard work. You see, the nature of how we do our life together is, you know, often we think like, hey, I'm gonna go to this conference on shame. And your real life is like outside these walls somewhere. Like you've come here, but this isn't real life. You've come here to like get some downloadable information that you can take it home and apply it to your spouse, your children. Maybe to your pastor. I want to tell you, this in this room is real life. It's not like your real life like lives someplace else. Like you are in the room, right? You're here doing work right now. Here's the question. It's not like how smart are you going to be at the end of the next 2 days? You're not going to be much smarter. You're going to have more you're going to have a lot of information at your disposal in the next 2 days. My job is not to make you smarter. My job is to invite you to be willing and excited to go home and do the work. And that's hard to do. And we're not going to want to do it. I will tell you right now. We're not going to want to do it. A room full of 350, 400 people. The data would suggest that only about 10% of the people in this room will take what we talk about and apply it beyond these walls. That's pretty sobering. And so we're all wondering, like, is it me? I hope to goodness I'm not in the 90%. But it's true. And one wonders then, why is it that Jesus says, narrow is the gate, and few there are that pass therein? I would suggest it's narrow because it's hard to do. And Jesus knows this. And he's not being critical or shaming because it's hard. I would imagine him walking into this room and saying, like, you're right, like, it's hard. Let's keep doing this. It's hard. Let's keep doing this. There's another thing that's important for us to talk about, and this, you'll see, y'all have a handout, little handout there, right? I think you'll see this little question that I've put there, like, who's telling what story? And just to give you, again, some full disclosure about how you're hearing this story rolled out over the next couple of days. There's a phrase that we like to use in the world of science and in the world of anthropology called plausibility structures. Plausibility structures. And it's a fancy schmancy phrase that means the following. In the same way that a fish is swimming in water and it doesn't really know that it's swimming in water, most of us are swimming in cultural waters, the notion and the nature of which we're not really that aware of. For example, science is the primary author of the story that the world is currently telling. What do I mean by that? I mean that we don't talk about much of anything without talking about research. You don't put a toilet in your house without knowing, like, how many gallons per flush is it getting, right? And how do we know this? Well, because we've done tests have been done. Research shows, right? There's nothing that we do that is not informed by science, which is why following Jesus, if you can't prove it, to much of the world doesn't have anything to say. But I want to suggest to you that this is a particular, science is a particular way of knowing things. We come to know things by setting up experiments in science, right? And you test things. And you see which things are true and which things are not true consistently over time. And that's a way for us to know things. But there's an interesting thing about that way of knowing. One is that it is dominantly a process that uses your left brain work, which we'll talk about in just a bit. Like, how does your left brain actually operate? It's a logical linear processor. And I like to know that I know that I know that I know, and so we set up these experiments. But there's an interesting thing about how we set up experiments. If I'm the one who's designing the experiment, it means I'm the one who's asking the questions. And if I'm asking the questions, it means I automatically limit the kinds of answers that can be answered. Does that make sense? But it means because I'm asking the questions and I'm the only one asking the questions, then I get to determine what the limits of those answers are. And that's a way of knowing things that takes a certain kind of work and it doesn't require the participation of another person. I'm just gonna set this up and we're gonna go. But I wanna suggest to you that there's a different way of knowing. Leslie Newbegin talks about this, and so does St. Paul. When in 1 Corinthians chapter 8, the second and third verses, he says this, "There are those who believe that they know, who do not know as they ought. But the person who loves God is known by God." Notice St. Paul here does not say the person who loves God knows God. He says the person who loves God is known by God. He repeats this notion in Galatians. He repeats it later in 1 Corinthians. In that great hymn, speaking of love, "That day we will know even as we are known." Now you see, if you are a patient that comes to our office and you're depressed or you're anxious, or you're a congressman, which is one, you know, one or the other, right? Kind of redundant, right? You come with a certain set of problems and you want those problems to be solved. And you may have questions of your own, but there's gonna be a different way of knowing that begins to happen for you in the office. You see, because when you come in and you give me the freedom to ask you questions, right? If I'm the patient, I'm now not the one who's asking questions. Someone else is asking questions of me. Kind of like what happened about 2 months ago. I'm meeting with a gentleman that I would say is really effective in life. He's in his 40s, he still is. In his 40s, married, 3 kids, wildly successful in his business, but anxious as the day is long and doesn't understand how he is so anxious when everything around him looks like it's just turning to gold. And one of the first questions I asked him, as we often do when we're talking about their families, one of the first questions I asked him was, "Well, tell me, what was it like growing up in your family?" And he said, "Well, I had two really loving parents, and I had an older sister. She had some trouble, but we all got along pretty well." And then I asked the next question, "Oh, so who was in charge of discipline in your house?" You know, you just your average common cocktail party question. You've been there when someone just says, "Hey, so who's in charge of discipline in your house?" And he said, "Well, I guess it would mostly be my mom because, well, we tried to stay away from my dad. We didn't want my dad to really have to be in charge of discipline." "Well, why was that?" "Well, you know, my dad sometimes could, you know, he had a little bit of a temper." "Oh, like how much of a temper?" "Oh, you know, well, he could raise his voice, right? Did he ever?" "Well, as it turns out, his father was categorically brutal while being a deacon in the church." Now, how is it that we find ourselves telling a story in which I start by saying to the answer to the question, "Who's in charge of the discipline of your house?" Like, "My mom," or, "Tell me about your family. I have two loving parents." How is it that one of those loving parents is categorically brutal? You see, already, there's something about his life that he doesn't know. Until someone else gives him the opportunity to be known in that context. Does that make sense? To be known requires the presence of another person who's going to be asking you questions, or a person of whom you will be asking questions. Not unlike our God who comes calling in Genesis 3, "Adam, where are you?" Not unlike, as we will again come back to over and over again, not unlike the first words of Jesus recorded in the Gospel of John are not, "Repent, for the kingdom of God is here." Remember what those first words of Jesus are in Gospel of John? And John the Baptist, seeing Jesus, said, "Behold, the Lamb of God." And he sent his two disciples after him. And following after him, Jesus turned and saw them and said to them, "What are you looking for?" What are you looking for? You see, there are certain things that we don't know that we don't know until someone else starts to ask us questions. Does that make sense? It's a different way of knowing. And it is not science's way, but it is the way that we all long mostly to be known. And I would say that in the end, we know things always in the service of being known. I want to know that this is the right thing to do in the service of relationships, because we were made to live like God lives. Unfortunately, we live in the world of Amazon.com. We do, right? We live in the world of the cell phone, the smartphone, which will give us everything we want when we want it, except for the next 2 hours. I'm going to ask Ben to play us 2 minutes of music, and I want you to put your writing utensils down. I just want you to sit and listen to 2 minutes of music. Gustav Holst, the planets, Jupiter specifically. It's the middle section, put later to two different hymns. Did you like that? I would suggest that it has taken Holst a long time. This was first written in 1921. It took Holst a long time to get to a point where he could write that. What evil would love for these 2 days to be about would be for us to somehow capture this moment, these things that we learn about shame and regeneration, and that be what this is about. We're not here to enjoy 2 days of learning about things. You see, what I want us to do is not just to come and enjoy something like Gustav Holst's music. I want us to go home and learn how to write it. Are you with me?
Yes.
And that's not easy to do, because Amazon.com and McDonald's and our smartphones want us to be able to do things now. And God is in the business of taking a long time to do things. I'm so mad at him about this. Like, I'm 54 years old. Why is it that now I'm discovering things that I wish I had known when I was 24? My wife is asking the same questions. Right? Because we know the next time we lose our temper with our kid. We know the next time that we do the thing that we swore we would never do again. We know that this is not how life is to be. We long for a world of goodness and beauty, and we want it now. Like we want those last 2 minutes of music, like going to a concert, and somehow thinking that listening to the music is the same thing as being able to play it. Jesus is inviting us into a place where we are not just listening to music, but we are making it. And where is that mostly taking place in our lives? Well, when it comes to this notion of shame, and when it comes to the work that we do, the place that all this intersects is in our minds. Okay? If we didn't have minds, we wouldn't be talking about shame, because we sense it, we image it, we feel it, we think, we have all these experiences with it, and it happens in our mind, which is kind of nice that you've got a psychiatrist here to talk to you about it. You know, you wonder, you know, you'd like to know that we know something about the mind if we're a shrink. You see there in your outline, there's this word called integration, right? You see that? Integration, we're going to talk about that in some detail in just a moment. Integration, in the language of interpersonal neurobiology, this fancy, again, another fancy term that is referring to this convergence of a number of different sciences that all have something to say about the activity of the mind. The word integration would be said in the Gospels like this: therefore, be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is also perfect. Not perfect as in without blemish. Perfect as in whole. Be whole, even as your Father in heaven is also whole. Be integrated, even as your Father in heaven is also integrated. Now, my colleagues who have this idea about the word integration are not people of faith, and they wouldn't have any sense that they're actually talking about the gospel. But they are, because God does not leave himself without a witness. And so to be integrated, from an interpersonal neurobiological perspective, is to be whole, as in the Sermon on the Mount. That's what we're talking about. It means for us to love the Lord our God with all of our heart, mind, soul, strength. And in order for us to do that, to love him with all of who we are, it might not be a bad idea for us to find out, well, what exactly is that that we're thinking about? When we read Romans chapter 12, and St. Paul says, therefore, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Like, what the heck is that? The renewing of my mind. Like, how do I'm just gonna, I renew it by binging on Netflix. That's how I do that, right? Right, there's a new show. That's how I renew my mind, right? This sense of, what does it mean to renew our mind? And if so, if I can renew my mind, how would I even know that that's happening? I mean, I don't know about you. There's all kinds of things that we read in the New Testament, Old Testament texts that are good ideas, and I have no idea what they mean. Anybody here, you probably know, you're really smart. You don't suffer with this problem. So this notion, we're going to come back. Here's one for you. Therefore, you have died. This is Colossians chapter 3. I love this verse. Therefore, you have died, and you are hidden with Christ in God. Isn't that beautiful? What does that mean? hidden in with Christ, I don't see him, where? You follow me. I want to suggest that by the time we are done here, we're going to have embodied ways of thinking about what that means. What does it mean for us to be integrated? What does it mean for our minds to be whole? What does it mean for us to love the Lord our God with all of our heart, mind, soul, and strength? Well, if we're going to answer that question, we first want to know, what is the mind? And we have a little working description there for you that we're going to walk through over the next few minutes. So I'm just going to say, so the mind, from an interpersonal neurobiological perspective, the mind, where evil wants to do its work using shame, the mind is an embodied and relational process that emerges from within and between brains, whose task it is to regulate the flow of energy and information. You have that, right? You got that? Pretty straightforward. Is this just a Texas thing? Right, so the mind, and we're gonna walk through this. So the mind is an embodied and relational process that emerges from within and between brains, whose task it is to regulate the flow of energy and information. You're like, great. What difference does that make? What difference does it make to my friend Steve? Steve came to see me in his mid to late 50s and was terribly depressed. He was wickedly smart and still is, but terribly depressed. And he was depressed because 6 months before he came to see me, his 17-year-old son had hanged himself. Now, Steve's story was interesting in that when he walked into the office, he was quick to make sure that I knew that he didn't want to have anything to do with any faith language. No faith talk. He said, I don't really believe in God. I was referred to you by some friends of mine. They said that you could help me with my depression. You might be able to give me an antidepressant. And that's why I'm here, but I don't really want to talk about God. I'm like, fine, we don't need to talk about God. But it's also true that if we want to talk about your depression, we have to talk about your mind. And if we're going to talk about your mind and not talk about God, we still have to talk about all that your mind means. Now, as a scientist, he was open to that because he likes data. And he was willing to listen to this. And so we talked at first about how, you know, our mind is first embodied. Now, what does this mean? Our mind is not, just so you know, your mind is not just limited to your brain, right? It's not just that, right? Your brain is important, you know, for the most part, right? You have approximately 100 billion neurons. And each of those neurons can have anywhere from connecting to one to about 10,000 different other neurons. Can you imagine how many, that kind of contact with that many other, like, children? Oof, right. Cousins, siblings, 1 to 10,000. But your brain is not the only part of your mind, because how do we know if you're in the audience, right? Like, how do you know that you're anxious? How do you know you're anxious? Your stomach, your hands, your heart rate, a whole range of things about your body tell you that you're anxious. If we don't have bodies, there's a great deal about how our mind operates that simply leaves the building. And here's the thing. We don't pay much attention to our bodies. We just don't do it. Which is odd, right? Because when you read the second chapter of Genesis, in the 7th verse, it says this, and the Lord God formed the man out of the dust of the earth, and he breathed the breath of life into man's nostrils, and man became a living being. It does not say, and he formed the man out of the breath of life, and he threw some dust into it, and he became a living soul. He starts with dirt. We are dirt, and we are breath. And if you take either of them away, we stop existing. Your body is crucially important as a part of your mind. It's not just something that happens to carry around your soul. But how well do we pay attention to our bodies? We are embodied. And we are relational. So the mind is an embodied and relational process. When you're born, about 30% of the neurons that you need to survive are actively engaged and talking to other neurons in the brain. The other 70 to 80% of those neurons that need to come online in order for you to thrive and survive, they require an interaction with another human being in order for them to be activated. consider how much of our life, how much of our flourishing depends upon our interaction with another relationship. We need relationships in order for our brains to become what our brains are going to become. I find it striking, again, in those first texts in the Bible, right? There's the first one, Genesis 1, 26 and 27. And God said, let us make mankind in our image, plural. We serve a pluralistic God. We serve a communal God. We serve a God who has made us such that our brains need other brains in order for us to flourish. So in order for me to love the Lord my God with all of my heart and my mind, I cannot do it by myself. I need the presence of other people. But I got to tell you, what evil would love for me to believe, evil would love for me to believe that it is my job to do it by myself. And it is my job to do it really well by myself. The problem is I know that I don't do it because I'm a professional sinner. But that means I'm just going to work that much harder to do it well, despite the fact that I know that I'm not ever going to. Because I don't really, you know, to love other people with other, to love God with other people, like together, that means I might end up being known by you. Heavens to Betsy. I mean, to be known by other people, like really? You want to know the last time I looked at pornography? You really want to know that? You want to know the last time that I really, really greedily wanted this particular new thing? You really want to know all my dark places? Really? We were made for each other. And this is what's difficult, right? We were made for each other. The mind is an embodied and relational process. The mind is moving. It's not static. Process. Later, tomorrow, we're going to talk about one of the primary neurophysiological things that shame does is that it draws us to a place of stasis. We stop moving when shame is active. We literally will physically, emotionally, cognitively stop all motion when shame is activated. One of the most effective things to do to help people when they're ashamed is to literally get them to stand up and walk. Well, I don't want to walk because I feel too bad. Getting people, like, I'm ashamed, I don't get out of bed. I got to get out of bed. Movement is one of the primary signs biologically of life. The mind is a process. We are constantly moving. And I'm like, you know, unless you're like a 14-year-old boy, right? Hey, how was school today, hon? Really? Could you be a little more vague? The mind is always moving. So the question is not, is my mind moving? The question is, what is my pace? What is my pace? And when I feel stuck and stagnant, we can know two things. Number one, that shame is at work. And number two, that I'm probably disconnected from other minds. So the mind is embodied. I'm going to love God with this body of mine. The mind is embodied, relational process that emerges. It is emergent. By emergent, we mean that it is a process in which the whole is larger than the sum of its parts. And this is something that I would have to say I don't like, among many things that I don't like. Because how many of us are like in this room who really like to know the plan for the day, right? How many of you like to know the plan for the next like 30 years of your life, right? We want to know that we know that we know. I want to know that when we add 1 + 1, we're going to get 2, right? Do the math. But you see, God, in his infinite wisdom, I would say some other word, right? Chooses not to tell me all the details about my unfolding life. Here's one of them. Who could have known? 6 years ago, I write a book, Anatomy of the Soul. 18 months ago, another book comes out. But who could have known that somewhere between 6 years ago and today, a guy by the name of Dave Leonard picks up that first book, has a go at it, and before you know it, between him and Dan and many others, this gathering is happening. I had no idea. I couldn't have seen this. God is constantly at work bringing all kinds of things to an emergent whole in which the whole is larger than the sum of its parts. What drives me crazy about this is that I want access to all the data. I want access to all of these emerging parts because if I don't have them, then I might not be able to live life the way I'm supposed to. And this is where evil loves to do its work. Because when I don't know things, perhaps I won't do things well enough. And I will fulfill my destiny of not being enough. Are you with me? And as we're going to see over the course of our time, we talk about shame. Like, shame is very molecular. And by molecular, I mean it operates in ways that are kind of like, as far as the brain is concerned, operates in ways in which, like, I just sense things. I image things. I don't have to think it. Like, I feel it. And I'm responding to things that I feel that are shaming. And I don't even know that I'm doing this. And so this emergent process is also, however, this is the beautiful thing, right? So I'm limited. I wish I weren't limited. I want to have all the data. I don't want to have to depend on other people that I can't predict and control. Right? We have children to control them. And then they somehow won't be. I don't get it. But this is what's really interesting. In complex systems, in physics, in complex systems, those systems that are emergent tend to be those things that are most beautiful, most complex, because of this property of the whole being larger than the sum of its parts. As we're going to see later this afternoon, the most beautiful things that we make, we do so in concert with other vulnerable parties that also don't have the view to all the data. It's an emergent thing. We're loving God with parts of us that we don't know that we don't know. I don't know my future. Heck, I sometimes don't even understand my past, right? But I will tell you what helps me make the difference for both of these things is the presence of other people, which of course is part of the problem. We actually need other people in order for me to understand and be living into my future, but making sense of my past. I can't do that by myself. My brain won't allow it. It's an emergent process whose task it is to regulate the flow of energy and information. Task is to regulate the flow of energy and information. By energy, we literally mean all that neurobiochemical stuff that's going on in all of your neurons that are flowing all over your body. That's what we mean by energy, quite literally. By information, we mean all the meaning that we give to it. So for instance, right now, it's 10:29. Some of you are sitting here and you're thinking, I should have gone to the bathroom. Gosh, why can't we have our break now? Right? Because you have a sensation. You know what I mean. And the sensation runs to your brain and tells you that you're sensing something. And then you have a thought. You have the thought of like, oh, I really want to go, but I can't go because I'll be the only one and they'll shame me on the way out the door. Right? So we have these minor sensations that happen to us like all day, throughout the day, that we are giving meaning to. Right? So I have the sense that I have to go to the bathroom and suddenly it becomes like a social issue. And here's the thing, like, just so you know, you're not alone with this. There are 300 people who want to go to the bathroom. We may have some with bladders of steel. Thanks be to God. because she knows she doesn't want to wait for 20 minutes. I mean, like, after the line starts to form. This is the important thing to know. We are always making meaning out of our minds. There is not a time. Like when you're asleep, your brain is dreaming. You are trying to make meaning out of the things that you sense. The energy that is coursing through your body 24/7, we are constantly in the business of making meaning out of things, regulating this flow of energy and information. And you wonder, like, gosh, if I'm gonna love the Lord my God with all of my mind, it can't be that hard, can it? Until we start to see what our mind actually is, until we see that it's an embodied and relational process, until we see that it's emergent, until we see that it's not just coming from within my brain, but coming between my brain and other people's brains. This work of loving God with all of who we are is hard to do. It's so hard, I would suggest, that in order for us to do it well, we can only do it with God helping us do it. It's the only way we can do it. Because I'm a professional sinner. Now, there's a couple of other things. There are items listed that we're going to just want to list, talk about briefly before we give your break. Yep. The first is this, you'll see this word called neuroplasticity. See that word? Now, neuroplasticity is a word that refers to the brain's capacity to flexibly change its wiring pattern. Now, 25 years ago, 30 years ago when I was in medical school, if you had a stroke and you were in the VA, where I was, you're the VA center, if you had a stroke, you would get an hour of physical therapy or occupational therapy a couple times a day, and you'd get that for about 6 weeks in the hospital, and then you'd be sent home and told good luck. Because that was all that we knew the brain could do. Now, if you have a stroke, we will send you to a rehabilitation center where you will work 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, regenerating parts of your brain. Because we've discovered that the brain actually has capacity to do three things. One, the brain can actually sprout new neurons. It's one way that neuroplasticity, the capacity for the brain to do new things, can sprout new neurons. Interestingly enough, especially in the part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is responsible for short-term memory, our capacity to remember new things. So it can sprout new neurons, number one. Number two, it can help the neurons that are already there to enlarge. They can grow bigger, longer, thicker, which makes them more capable of behaving more efficiently. All kinds of stories about how people are able to do things that they weren't able to do or were once able to do after injuries because of what the brain's now able to do. The third thing that they can do, and this is also really important, is that they're able to be more deeply and densely connected to other neurons. One interesting feature about neuroplasticity is this, is that anytime the brain is given the opportunity to be stressed, and the brain is stressed, and stressed up to the point where it's not destroyed, a couple things will start to happen. That stress response will lead to some inflammation in the brain. But that inflammation process is intended to begin a healing process. But if intentional acts of regeneration are enacted, if we send you off to that rehabilitation center to repair the rupture in the brain, an interesting thing can happen. The connections that those neurons used to have before the injury, after the rehab of the injury, after the repair of the rupture, those connections are actually stronger than they were before. Stronger than they were before. Here's the good news. It used to be that we just thought that if you were in trouble with your brain, you're just in trouble with your brain. It used to be thought that if I grew up in this family, like Steve, our friend, whose son hanged himself, for Steve, for him to hear all these things, right? For him to hear all these things, he was having to hear some things about his brain, and he'd been depressed for 6 months, stuck in a place where he couldn't move, feeling very much like, all I gotta do is take an antidepressant and this will like help me feel better. Steve needed to know that part of his problem wasn't just about his son hanging himself. But part of Steve's problem, as we'll get to in just a bit, part of Steve's problem had a lot to do with the story that he had been telling himself for well over 50 years. Because you see, when we tell ourselves stories, we think, we image, we feel, we sense, we do all kinds of things with our body, and that activates neural network activity. And those neurons, as we say in the business, they fire together to wire together. Hebb's axiom. Donald Hebb was a Canadian neuropsychologist who took this research and someone coined this phrase, this notion that the more we practice thinking certain things, feeling certain things, making meaning out of certain energy over certain things, the more we practice this over and over, the more permanent it becomes in your brain. And so your relationship with your father that somehow keeps showing up in your marriage is there because of neuroplasticity. And you're thinking like, oh my gosh, my dad has been dead for 10 years. What am I gonna do? Or, oh my goodness, I've parented this child for this many years. What am I gonna do? The good news is this, your brain can change. And so St. Paul, when he says, therefore, don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the image, transformed by the renewing of your mind. That renewal is not metaphor. That renewal is about real, intentional, neurobiologic change. The resurrection is for real. This is not just some fairy tale. The problem for many of us is that we live as if that's all that it is when it comes to how it actually gets operationalized in our minds, which we'll come to later. We like to say that we like to snag the brain. And this is what we're telling our friend Steve. We're gonna snag the brain, another acronym from my friend Dan Siegel. We stimulate neuronal activation and growth. If we want our minds to change, we have to get the brain to change. And to do that, we stimulate neurons so that they can fire differently. And there are some things that you can do differently to get them to fire differently. The first thing that you can do is aerobic exercise. You know that. So the more, like even if it's 10 minutes a day, walking is better than not walking at all. Aerobic exercise stimulates the activity of the brain to enable and facilitate neuronal activation. Aerobic exercise. Number two, diet. I had room service this morning. I was telling Shelly this. I had room service this morning for breakfast. They brought me a farm. I mean, I wanted two scrambled eggs. I think they were ostrich eggs. Two links of sausage. They were like two legs of a pig. I know they're in Texas. I know. I get it. In America, we do two things with food. We eat too much and we eat too quickly. So quite simply, one of the ways for us to address diet, because there are like dozens of dietary things that we can do, right? That are all, many of them are really helpful. But two things that you can do quite simply is to whatever you're thinking about eating for a meal, typically cut it in half. We're not gonna do this. Now, I could do this morning because like we could have fed four of us for my breakfast. Think about this, cut it in half. Number two, eat more slowly. Intentionally, don't let yourself eat a meal in under 45 minutes. Right, you're like, you've gotta be like what planet are you living on? Like, first I have to go exercise, and then I gotta take 45 minutes to eat my meal. Third, this is all like for your brain, right? Third, sleep. On average, we now sleep approximately 2 hours per night less than we did 100 years ago in this country, on average. Probably in the last 10 years, it's even less, right? So here's some things that I would suggest that we think about doing about sleep. Number one, and you're gonna love this, right? Number one, I'm gonna invite you to turn off all screen access at least 1 hour before planning on going to bed. And you're like, oh great, I'll just go to bed at 1 o'clock in the morning. Right, here's a way to help your sleep. Think about Sabbathing your technology. What does this mean? One, at least 1 hour before your normal bedtime, you're gonna shut down all screens, which means you're not gonna check email, you're not gonna check Facebook, you're not gonna check your phone. Nobody needs you at 10 o'clock at night. I gotta guarantee you. Not unless you're somebody who's on call for something. You know, you're a doula, you gotta go deliver a baby. Nobody's email needs you at 10 o'clock at night. Okay, number one. Number two, when you come home at night, you have a common place to put your phones. And you're only gonna check your phone if somebody calls you. You're like, I'm not coming back tomorrow. Number three, in the morning, you are not gonna check any technology until and or unless you've done proper attention to your mind, which means if you do things like private prayer, meditation, scripture reading, those kinds of things, breakfast, which of course you're gonna take 45 minutes to eat and only half of what you ate yesterday. Gosh, this doesn't make sense. The physics doesn't, I eat less but take longer to do it. That just doesn't, I don't get that. What? And like, but I'm already nervous because I can't check my phone. This is all inviting you to rest, which is what sleep is about. There is not a single more important, singular neurophysiologic thing you do than to sleep. The fact that we don't sleep as long or as well means that we are increasing our risk for Alzheimer's disease. Well, that'll scare you. All right. Okay, I'm putting my phone away right away. Three other things that we'll talk more about as the rest of our time goes on. One, so there's those first three. And the next is meaningful novelty. What are you engaged in that is actively creative, that is meaningful, and that is novel, that is new? And by new, I don't mean like memorizing the phone book. That might be new, that's not very creative, okay? And I guess we don't have phone books, do we? Right, so this question. What new language are you learning? Have you taken a painting class? Have you taken a pottery class? Are you building furniture? Are you writing articles? Are you writing a book? Like, what are you gonna do to create? You're like, gosh, I've got no time because I gotta sleep more, I gotta eat longer, I'll be living in a box under a bridge because I'll be out of a job because I'm just taking care of my neuroplasticity. Meaningful novelty, number one. Number two, mindfulness practices, which we're gonna talk about when it comes to the contemplative tradition of Christian faith. What does it mean for us to do the kind of prayer that the contemplative tradition asks for us? What's this got to do with shame? It's got a lot to do with this. Right, and look, if we are shame bound, the way that we need to make that different is we need to make our brains more flexible. And the last thing is this, deeply connected interpersonal relationships. Deeply connected interpersonal relationships leads to neuroplastic flexibility because somebody else is asking the questions. Those are the six things. This last bullet before we go. A word about emotion. It's everywhere, it's in everything. There's nothing that we do that is not emotional. We like to say in the business that emotion is the energy around which the brain organizes itself. Everything that we're doing is a regulatory process of that. So it's not really gonna be okay to say, well, he's not really emotional. Yes, he is, he's just not letting you know. Right? It's how we are regulating this. And The reason that that's important is because that is primarily what shame is.